after many months in the letter to the Romans to the Old Testament again, and we're going to take up a series which I've entitled Lights in a Dark Place. Lights in a Dark Place. And one of the main reasons for this is that it seems that that is what we are called to be, because the place and the time is exceedingly dark as far as spiritual things are concerned. In our land, we could say in the whole world, but certainly in our land at this time, it's a dark place and it's a sinister place. And everything seems to be calculated to wipe out any true evangelical Christian belief. Everything seems to be designed to make everything conform to what the appetites of men and women are. We're seeing days in which the churches bend over backwards to take in the latest trends in government policy and to the feelings of various people of various persuasions. And we're living in days when the church is at an all-time low as far as its resilience and its standing up for the old truths, the truths of the scriptures. Place after place which has been a stronghold of the faith has knuckled under, buckled under, and has given in, and there is weakness. But still there are lights in a dark place. We often pray, don't we, for individual churches where we know that they're faithful to the gospel, where we know that they'd rather die than preach another gospel. They're few, but still there are many in our land. There are not a handful, there are many who love the truth and would declare it. And it seemed to me that there is a period in history, in the scriptures, where there was a very dark place, and I'm speaking about the northern kingdom of Israel. And I'll go through that. We're going to look over the next few weeks at those lights which God still maintained in a very dark place, with a view to aspiring to be those lights, to be those that call upon the Lord, seek his grace, and are helped and enabled by him to be firm witnesses for the truth in our families and in our neighbourhood and as far as our ministry as a church is concerned going forward. So we read from 1 Kings chapter 15, and we're referring to the dark place and dark time of that particular period. It's a 210 year period from 931 BC through to 722 BC. And I want to take us perhaps a text that we're going to lean towards the words which we find here at the beginning. Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all Israel were come to Shechem to make him king. So the dark time is 210 year period, 931 through to 722 BC. And the dark place is the land of Israel to the north of the land allotted to the two tribes of Judah and Benjamin. We read that Judah were the only tribe, but Benjamin were down there as well, and they joined with Judah, and they continued to worship in the temple in Jerusalem. But we're talking about the land of the ten tribes. It's known more often than not as Samaria in the Old Testament times. So we're looking this morning in anticipation of the series ahead of us as to how Israel in 931 BC became the dark place at a dark time. Actually, one of these tribes, Simeon, land was south of Judah. But by the time the rebellion took place that we read about in 1 Kings 12, Simeon had been absorbed into Judah. And there was one tribe, Dan, whose allocated land was next to Benjamin, to the west. But they didn't like that land, and they migrated north to be the most northerly of the ten tribes. So we often speak about the southern kingdom and the northern kingdom. What we mean is Judah and Benjamin, often referred to just as Judah, who still worshipped in the temple in Jerusalem, and that's the southern kingdom. And to all others, as Israel or Samaria, the northern kingdom. Just a little bit of background. When you read through 1 Kings, followed by 2 Kings, you have a thorough history of the kings of Israel and Judah. But then as you're reading, you move on to 1st and 2nd Chronicles, and you get a sense of deja vu, because it's the same historical period. However, it can be seen on closer study that there are certain differences in emphasis. The books of Kings contain a record of both Israel and Judah, whereas Chronicles majors on Judah. There's not much about the northern kingdom in the book of Chronicles, the books of Chronicles. Also, Kings speaks much of judgments, whereas Chronicles is the place that you find much more hope for the future. There's an emphasis on the wars of Israel in Kings, but the major centerpiece in Chronicles is the temple and all that happened in and around the temple. The book of Kings, or the two books of Kings, give equal coverage to all the kings, but Chronicles traces more evidently the messianic line of David. David, Solomon, Rehoboam, etc. Kings majors on morality, or the lack of it. The book of Chronicles, or the books of Chronicles, bring out the promise and the provision of repentance. Well, we're going to study this week the events surrounding the rebellion, which brought about the split. Then, in future weeks, we'll look at certain bright lights, which still shone in a dark place and time. In 2 Chronicles 10, and here, Solomon has died. You remember that the three kings so far have been Saul. The people demanded a king, and God gave them Saul. And Saul, indeed, increased all their taxes, took their children, and made them his soldiers, and was not really a very good king, and God deposed him. And then David took his place, and David was a king after God's own heart. He wasn't perfect, and his sins are recorded, as well as his very good, godly life. His psalms, of course, reflect the spiritual life that he had. When you read the Psalms, you have no doubt where David stood with regard to his relationship to God. He is like a New Testament saint. And all the promises concerning the Messiah are that he would be the son of David. He would be a son of a son of a son of a son of David in literal terms. But Rehoboam is the next son after Solomon. Solomon took David's place. Solomon had a mixed life. He started off with great wisdom. He delved into looking all over the place for satisfaction, and then he came back to the Lord when he wrote Ecclesiastes and Proverbs. So they had a godly king at the time when Solomon died, but he had left something of a legacy of destruction due to his period away from the Lord. And we read that Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all Israel were come to Shechem to make him king. But there was a man called Jeroboam, and he was in Egypt, and he had fallen out with Solomon, and he'd fled to Egypt from the presence of King Solomon. So that's where he lived, but the people had remembered Jeroboam, and they had fears about Rehoboam. They had fears because they thought, well, the heavy tax system, the laws concerning what we can do or what we can't do, they're a bit strict. And so they said Jeroboam might be able to persuade Rehoboam. So they sent and called him, and Jeroboam, we read in verse 3, and all the congregation of Israel came and spoke unto Rehoboam. So Rehoboam had fled from the presence of the king. It goes back to the days when Solomon had been strengthening the city of Jerusalem. He'd been impressed with the hard work of this young man, Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. That's all in 1 Kings chapter 11. And he promoted him to be ruler over all the charge of the house of Joseph. And Jeroboam met a prophet one day called Ahijah. And Ahijah took a garment and tore it into 12 segments. And he said, the kingdom of Israel is going to be split into 12 pieces. And Jeroboam, you will be given 10 of these pieces, 10 tribes, to rule, as a punishment to the great number of Israel who'd fallen already into idolatry. The charge to Jeroboam was, you must be faithful to the Lord. Well, he certainly wasn't. Jeroboam used this information to rebel against Solomon. And when Solomon found out, he banished him from Israel. Now the tribal leaders in Jerusalem, or the leaders of all the tribes as they met together, saw fit to invite Jeroboam back first of all to plead for them with King Rehoboam, and if necessary, to lead a rebellion against him. And we read, "And Jeroboam and all the congregation of Israel came and spake unto Rehoboam, saying, Thy father made our yoke grievous. Now therefore make thou the grievous service of thy father, and his heavy yoke which he put upon us lighter, and we will serve thee." And Rehoboam can't make his mind up. He says, "Give me 3 days." There in verse 5, "Depart yet for 3 days, then come again unto me." And the people departed. And then Rehoboam takes the Anglican compromise, and he tries to get the best of both worlds. He asks the opinion of the old men who were there. They saw everything that happened during the days of King Solomon, and they saw that it was good that the king should do something to alleviate some of the hardships upon the people. But the people of Israel had chosen Jeroboam as their spokesman. Rehoboam sought advice from the older counsellors and promptly decided that he didn't like their advice, and he went to the younger friends who didn't have the same experience or wisdom of the older counsellors. Well, this isn't just meant to be a history lesson. Who do you look to for guidance? We learn from the character traits and the actions and the reactions of these people we are studying. Rehoboam was humble enough, or maybe confused enough, to seek some guidance. We live in a day we can be so influenced by the views and the philosophy of society that we find ourselves under attack, and we start to think, well, maybe I should give in on this. Maybe they're right about that. And it's no longer politically correct to hold on to certain standards which stood for our fathers in good stead for centuries. In Jeremiah, the prophet, he urges the people to stand in the ways, that means at the crossroads, and to ask for the old paths. Not because old is necessarily best, but because the old paths of righteousness and truth are sound and reliable and God-pleasing. So Rehoboam consulted with the old men, and they said, "If thou wilt be a servant unto this people this day, and will serve them and answer them, and speak good words to them, then they will be thy servants forever." Then Rehoboam, having asked the men who had years of experience serving Solomon, who was a wise king for most of his life, he was not happy with their answers, went to his own age group. What was he doing? Well, he was trying to get the sort of advice he would have given. He had a mind to exert his authority and to show who was on the throne now. He didn't want to be a weak king that just followed his father. He wanted his own path. Well, he did the opposite to what his father had written in the book of Proverbs. His father, Solomon, wrote, "Trust in the Lord with all thine heart, and lean not unto thine own understanding. In all thy ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct thy paths." Well, that's a wonderful maxim for life. We should have it written on our hearts, to trust in the Lord with all thine heart. When we come to those situations where we're thinking of asking this person or that person for advice or following some expedient, no, trust in the Lord with all thine heart. Lean not unto thine own understanding. In all thy ways acknowledge him. He shall direct thy paths. It's a wonderful promise. He was a man who asked for guidance, but he chose his own answer and the guidance which suited him. And the answer and guidance Rehoboam received from his peers, those he'd grown up with, were rather different, reflected a philosophy devoid of the sort of wisdom which the older men possessed. "What counsel give ye that we may answer this people? They spoke and said, Make the yoke which thy father did put upon us lighter. And the young men said, Thus shalt thou speak unto this people, saying, Thy father made our yoke heavy, but make thou it lighter unto us. Thus shalt thou say to them, My little finger shall be thicker than my father's loins. My father laded you with a heavy yoke, I will add to your yoke. My father chastised you with whips, I will chastise you with scorpions." Rehoboam was not happy with the answer of the older men, but decided to go with his own age group, the men that he had grown up with. What was he doing? Well, he was trying to get the sort of advice he would have given. He wanted to exert that authority. And we read that he forsook the counsel which the old men gave him, and took the counsel which the young men, which were brought up with him, which stood before him. He went and he brought their advice to bear upon his own life. The advice given by the younger generation was essentially, show them who's king around here. Flex your muscles now, or else they'll try to get away with murder. Well, it was the wrong advice, but it was of the Lord. The Lord allowed it. It was a judgment against the sin of idolatry. He was going to allow them to divide the kingdom. It was all part, really, if you look back to what he said to Samuel. These people have not rebelled against you, Samuel. They've rebelled against me. That's what the Lord said to Samuel in asking for a king, demanding a king. This was a third generation of result to that request. So they came on the third day. The king answered them roughly. King Rehoboam forsook the counsel of the old men and answered them after the advice of the young men, saying, my father made your yoke heavy. I will add thereto. He chastised you with whips. I will chastise you with scorpions. Well, the result was that only Judah and Benjamin remained under the rule of Rehoboam, son of Solomon. The rest of Israel, the 10 tribes, crowned Jeroboam, son of Nebat, as their king. I suppose there were only 9 tribes, really, because Simeon had virtually evaporated into Judah. Rehoboam's decision to follow the guidance of the rising generations was the cause of this disastrous split and the almost total apostasy of the northern kingdom. If you count through, there are 18 kings of Judah, and there are 18 kings of Israel. And of the 18 kings of Judah, there were 8 who you could say were godly. And even that 8, one of them ceased to be godly, and one of the ungodly ones became godly. Thinking of Joash and of Manasseh. So 8, on average, who were good kings out of 18. Of those good kings, some were very good. Men like Jehoshaphat and Hezekiah and Josiah were godly kings in Judah. But of the 18 in the north, there were none. Every one of them was bad. It's almost that they outdid each other. Of all the kings of Israel, there was none that did evil in the sight of the Lord like unto this man. So we have the same 3 choices. We do just what our lusts and appetites tell us. We realise we need spiritual help when we go to the Word of God and seek the Lord to take control in our lives. Or we simply don't do anything. We follow the way our generation's going. We think like the ungodly, talk like the ungodly, and follow the ways and trends of the ungodly. That's our 3 choices, really. It wasn't the fact that the older men were older that made them wiser. It was that the younger advisers had a rebellious and unreasonable way of looking at life and didn't mind influencing others in the same way. Well, King Rehoboam sent Hadoram, that was over the tribute, in order to try to bring the people back. And the children of Israel stoned him with stones, that he died. And King Rehoboam fled back to Jerusalem. And Israel, we read in verse 19, rebelled against the house of David unto this day. So we do well to remember that there is a way that seemeth right unto a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death. But then came the choice of a religion of convenience. And this is so subtle. The new king of Judah planned at first to take back the rule over the whole of Israel by force. And in chapter 21, when Rehoboam was come to Jerusalem, he assembled all the house of Judah with the tribe of Benjamin, 144,000 chosen men to fight against the house of Israel. God's ways are not man's ways, neither his thoughts, our thoughts. And Shemaiah the prophet was sent to Rehoboam to warn him that the split was in fact ordained by God. It was wrong. It shouldn't have happened. God allowed it in order to show men and women the result of allowing the world's philosophy to govern your thinking and living. The prospective bloodbath, Israel against Israel, was prevented. So how would the northern kingdom get underway under their new king? Well, the first thing Jeroboam did was to bring in a religion of convenience. The Jews were a religious people. They couldn't just go north and become atheists. They couldn't just go north and abandon the temple and all religion, because it was deeply ingrained in their hearts that there is a God in heaven. They'd been brought up to seek the Lord. There were some among them who were yet godly. Jeroboam, in verse 26, said in his heart, always got to be careful of what we say in our hearts. The fool has said in his heart that there is no God. Jeroboam said in his heart, now shall the kingdom return to the house of David. If this people go up to do sacrifice in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, then shall the heart of this people turn again unto their Lord, even unto Rehoboam king of Judah, and they'll kill me and go again to Rehoboam king of Judah. This was his fear, Jeroboam. Even though the Jews in the north, the northern kingdom, were no longer part of Rehoboam's kingdom, they still had a religion which had been ground into them, that they had to go to Jerusalem several times a year to offer sacrifices. They didn't go every week, obviously. The people in the north and the south, they would have had their own worship, their own. It was still very much the family that guided them. And then there were the priests, and they were there, and there were local assemblies. They didn't have the synagogue as such just yet, but it was not long before it came. And the people had a duty to go to Jerusalem to offer sacrifices at the Passover, the Feast of Tabernacles, the various times that they did this. And Rehoboam thinks, well, when they go down there and they see the temple, Solomon's temple, with all the grandeur and the splendour of that temple, he put so much into it. It was amazing, the materials and everything that he gave in order for that temple to be built. It was the most magnificent representation, and it did represent how you worship God. It was like based upon the tabernacle that God gave in the wilderness. So you imagine, here's Jeroboam, and he's thinking, oh yes, they're planning a trip next week to go to Jerusalem, most of them for the Feast of Tabernacles, say. And when they go down there to the Feast of Tabernacles, they'll see the temple, and they'll see the real priests in their priestly uniforms, and they'll have the word of God, the Psalms of David, many of them now being incorporated into the worship, and certainly the reading of the law from the Pentateuch. They'll hear all that in the temple, and his fear was, they shall kill me and go again to Rehoboam king of Judah. They're going to change their minds. He had to do something to stop them going to Jerusalem. So he took counsel, doesn't say of whom, he asked advice, and he made two calves of gold. And again, there's that sense of deja vu. Where did it all go wrong in the wilderness when they made a golden calf? Well, they made two calves of gold and said unto them, he said to the people, it's too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. It's too hard. Your religion shouldn't be that costly. It shouldn't be that much of a commitment to you to follow the Lord. Does it sound familiar? Doesn't that come as a voice to us when we get up on a Sunday morning and we think, I could do with another hour in bed and I could go tonight? It's too much for you to get up. It's too much of you to go up to Jerusalem. Behold thy gods. Here is a substitute for you. Now this was outlandish. To point to these gods, these idols, these calves, and say, behold thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. But the point that he really got over to them was, it's just too much for you to go to Jerusalem. And when you think, he says go up, even though Jerusalem was in the south, but it was high. Jerusalem was built on a mountain. And so it was meant to go and then to ascend the paths leading up to the temple after a heavy long journey. And then what would they do for the night? And then you've got to come back again. Behold, here are thy gods. He set one calf up in Bethel, and the other put he in Dan. This thing became a sin, for the people sent to worship before the one, even unto Dan. It's a religion of convenience. It's almost as bad as having no religion at all, or a false religion altogether. The basic reason behind it was not revealed to all the people of the 10 tribes, namely that Jeroboam feared that if they returned to Jerusalem for what was almost monthly or 6 weekly visits for the feasts and festivals and remembrances, Pentecost, the Day of Atonement, all those, it would make the Israelites want to make Rehoboam their rightful king again. Don't we see Satan in this? The fear that sinners would realise the foolishness of atheism and total rejection of God might dawn upon men and women. Satan must wonder that people could be so gullible as to think there is no God. What's his answer? Oh, give them a religion of convenience. The king's argument was, Jerusalem, or the journey's too much for you. It's too far. You can't be expected to take your religion that seriously. We must make it easier for you. Dan, in the north, that's a good suitable, far away from Jerusalem, further than anything from Jerusalem, location. We'll put a golden calf there for you. You're immediately going in the wrong direction because you're going north instead of south. Some would say that's going too far from Jerusalem. So I'll put another golden calf in Bethel. That was well on the way down towards Jerusalem. Bethel means house of God as well. So it's where Jacob found God. It's almost legitimate. That's how Satan reasons with us. Golden calves. If people won't accept the truth, they'll accept almost anything else. For some, the substitute convenience religion can be quite ridiculous. Worship the Virgin, pray to statues, confess to a priest. That's about as far from the truth as Dan was from Jerusalem. But it suits them. For others, they need a religion that's not too costly, but near enough to the truth to be loosely called evangelical. Like Bethel. Not quite Jerusalem, but pretty close. That's what happened to the Baptist Union in the days after Spurgeon, or during Spurgeon's time, as he preached, and he preached the soul-saving doctrines and truths of the gospel. The Baptist Union was capitalising and voting on whether you needed really to believe that Christ was divine, and they were voting on it. Satan is happy either way, so long as he's got you compromising, not truly committed to Christ. What was so inviting about the golden calf religion for the Israelites? Well, there was lots of mention of salvation. Because Jeroboam doesn't just say, here's a couple of golden calves, worship them instead of God. He says, no, these are your gods which saved you. They brought you out of the land of Egypt. It was something visible and touchable. People like a religion they can touch and see rather than faith. That's what happened really in the early days to bring about the Catholic Church. There were many people that said, no, we still want something we can see. And so they brought in a lot of the heathendom into the religious worship in the first couple of centuries as Rome decided to accept the Christian faith through Constantine. And then you didn't really have to believe it. There was something about it, having these golden calves. You didn't really believe it, but everybody else did, so you just went along with it. And it could be adhered to without too much of a journey. And I close, before we begin again next time with a light in a dark place, we're just asking you the question, how convenient is your faith? How easy is it for you to be a Christian? If it's that easy, are you there at all? Do you really have the Lord? Should you not now truly seek a greater commitment? We don't want golden calves, especially in our day. We're living in a dark time, in a dark place. It's time to step out for the Lord in a big way. Let's turn to our closing hymn.